So in this first session after breakfast, again, we're going to mainly focus on the meditation and again the shamatha practice. So as we did before breakfast, we're going to do two sessions, 20 minutes each with a 2-minute break. So let's begin. And we're going to continue to focus on the abdomen today as the focus of our shamatha practice this morning. So let's begin. So as always, we begin by preparing the body, setting the body into a state of relaxation, stillness, and vigilance. So vigilant posture, of course, means to simply keep the back nice and straight. And at the same time, allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. So using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension you may find in any part of the body. Softening and relaxing all the muscles in the face. Relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. Allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Not trying to control or regulate the breath in any way. And with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen, happily releasing them. Letting go of all thoughts of the past and the future. And simply allow the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Through focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body, wherever you can most easily notice any sensations associated with the breathing. And again, narrow the focus now and focus on the sensations of the breath in the area of the abdomen. Focusing on the sensations of the rising and lowering of the abdomen as you breathe. And maintain an ongoing flow of mindfulness of the sensations of the breath throughout the entire cycle of each in and out breath. If you notice that you're becoming agitated or distracted, then use the out-breath as an opportunity to relax, releasing any distractions and very gently returning to the breath. Or if you're noticing that you're simply becoming dull or spaced out, then use each in-breath as an opportunity to arouse and refresh your focus on the breath. Or if you find yourself constantly becoming distracted, then if you find it helpful, you might like to introduce counting the breath to help stabilize the mind. If you need to stretch your legs, you can do that now quietly. So once again, finding that nice, comfortable posture. The back nice and straight. And allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. And also keeping the body as still as possible, avoiding any unnecessary movement or fidgeting. And allowing the breathing to flow naturally and effortlessly. And without dwelling in the past, without anticipating the future, simply allow the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Simply focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. once again narrow your focus and focus on the sensations of the breath in the area of the abdomen. Using the rope of mindfulness to tie your attention to the sensations of the breath in the area of the abdomen. To help balance the mind, to help overcome agitation or distraction, we can use each out-breath as an opportunity to relax, to release any distractions, and very gently return to the breath. And to help overcome dullness or being spaced out, we can use each in-breath as an opportunity to arouse and refresh our focus on the breath. So relaxing on each out-breath and focusing on each in-breath. if you're becoming dull and spaced out because you're losing interest for the practice or enthusiasm for the practice, then every now and again, it's helpful to recall the benefits of doing this practice. And it can also be helpful to maintain a level of curiosity about this practice. For example, noticing if the sensations of the breath are the same on the out-breath as they are on the in-breath. Or noticing if the rhythm of your breath is changing over time or not. Before we begin our review, is there any questions about this practice that we're doing this morning? The breath practice of the abdomen? Anyone have any questions or queries about that? If you find it helpful, then you can use the Shavasana, the corpse posture. If you find that lying down there's less physical pain in the body, then use this as an alternative. Sleep, yeah. Of course, one thing that we can do is to not see that as a problem, because the thing is, whether it's some physical thing or mental thing, this difficult thing, if we see it as a problem, then automatically we're going to go, oh, not that again, I don't want that, please go away. And so all we're going to do is develop aversion to it. Oh, no, not that pain again. Oh, go away, I can't meditate with that. Soon as we do that, all we do is we magnify the amount of discomfort we feel. And then it really becomes more, because then we're really focusing on it, hoping and wishing that it would go away. And then it agitates the mind. We experience more discomfort, more suffering. So it just magnifies. So at least we can avoid that. At least we can avoid magnifying the level of discomfort by having aversion. So what we can do there is a couple of things to help. One is what's called practice acceptance, is to simply acknowledge, okay, at the moment I have this physical physical symptoms in the body. Okay. And of course, then we can follow great Indian master Shantideva from the 8th century, his advice. He says, if a situation can be remedied, why get upset? Just fix it. So if you can fix it by lying down or doing something, then fix it. And the other piece of advice he gives is, if the situation cannot be remedied, what's the point in getting upset? And that's what we do. We get upset. So if you can resolve it, resolve it. If you can't, then go, okay, it will pass eventually. And then just practice this acceptance. So at least then we won't have the aversion. We won't go, oh, no, please go away, and just magnify the amount of discomfort we feel. And that was really highlighted to me a couple of years ago. I had in one of my classes in India, I had a young Canadian lady in her mid-20s. And when she was 10 years before or so, early teens, I think, she had a problem in her neck and they had to fuse two vertebrae together. So she had restricted movement and a little bit of, discomfort because of that. But she then was so concerned or worried that this would cause a negative impact on her life, her ability to enjoy life, that she actually had constant pain in her neck, constant. And then she came to the course and we introduced this idea of mindfulness of breathing and relaxing and avoiding the aversion. And then from about day 3 of the 10-day course, she talked to me after the course about this. She said, from day 3, she had no pain in her neck for the first time in her life because she practiced acceptance. Of course, there was still some restriction of movement, but now she wasn't going, oh, no, this is going to cause me a lot of problems. I'm not going to enjoy life. And then she said, for the rest of the course, for the first time since they fused, she said she had no pain in her neck. So what we can understand from that is that often when we have these chronic conditions, a large part of the discomfort and suffering we feel is self-induced through aversion. So at least we can do something about that. Of course, there may be some level of discomfort there due to the nature of the physical ailment, but at least we can avoid magnifying that. So that's one thing we can do. Another thing we can do, and this is something that's going to come a little bit later in this retreat, is often when we have this sort of discomfort, whether it's physical or mental, we become super self-focused. Poor me, poor me, poor me. Yeah, and then this aversion kicks in. You know, oh, I don't want that. So the acceptance is a good start. And then what we can do is stop this obsessive self-focus by using this difficult situation to focus on others. So what we can understand is, like, an example in this case where we have some physical difficulty in our body, maybe we have migraine, headache, or anything, then we can go, okay, I'm not the only one on the planet that has this difficulty now. There must be thousands of other people who have similar, maybe even more a physical problem than me. So by me willingly accepting this because I can't resolve it right now, then may all others be free of their problem. So this is developing compassion for others. And by doing that, one is that we're using this difficult situation to make it meaningful. And secondly, often what you'll find is that because we're focusing on others, we don't have this obsessive self-focus, then the level of discomfort we feel drops. Even sometimes to the point where we don't even really notice any discomfort in our own body. You know, we sometimes see this, like, for example, you know, there's been a serious car accident and someone may have broken their leg and have extreme pain, but their partner is in a worse condition, and so they're so focused on trying to help their partner that they don't even notice that they've got a broken leg. So this can also help. So one is to, again, not to develop aversion going, oh, I don't want that, go away. Of course, the first step is if we can resolve it, fix it. You know, if we have a strong pain in the knee, maybe moving the knee, it'll go away. You know, then do that. But if we can't, then at least practice acceptance and not have this, or go away. And then on top of that, then to use that to really focus on others as well. So these sorts of things can be helpful in that situation for physical ailments. And of course then, you know, outside of meditation, if there's something we can do in terms of taking medication or exercise or something, to look at other ways of then working with that and improving our physical condition as well, of course. So these are some things that we can do. Yeah.
And that's why I asked yesterday about that breathing.
Sure.
And I asked that because just, it's easier for me when I just practicing at home.
Practicing?
When I'm practicing at home, I can just watch my emotions.
Sure.
Which arise like in connection with something.
Sure. Sure.
I feel pain, but that's not that a big problem. But then I'm trying to concentrate on breathing, then
too physical. Sure. Yeah. So then, in that case, maybe for you, then when you were doing the shamatha practice, it's better to focus on the mind, to use that as the object. You know, we don't have to use the breath as the object. We don't have to start with that. If we find that using the mind works best for us in our practice, shamatha practice, then we use that from the very beginning. But also, as I mentioned yesterday, I think this sometimes highlights the fact is maybe the reason that that is more effective for you is that you find the mind more interesting. And so the more the more that we're focused on something interesting, the less likely we're going to be focusing on the pain in the body. I mean, it's the same as in life, you know. Maybe we have a little bit of discomfort in the body, but then there's some super interesting program on TV and we're really absorbed in that. We don't notice that. But if we're sort of at home and there's something very boring on TV that we're watching, we're going to notice probably every little tiny pain in the body, aren't we? So this is the key here, is to, and that's what I tried to introduce into that last meditation, is actually, if we're curious about the breath, it can be very interesting. You can notice all sorts of little things about the breath. But if we have this idea, oh, the breath, that's very boring, then yes, probably all of us will then notice any little pain in the knee and distractions outside and be irritated by these things. So this can help. But again, what I would recommend is if you really find the mind works better, then use that. Use that as the object. And then again, in terms of the posture, find whatever posture that minimizes the physical discomfort. So if you find that lying down flat is better, or using the stool as you're doing is better, or chair, or whatever posture minimizes the discomfort in the body, then also use that as well. That's going to be very helpful. Okay.
I had yesterday such a feeling that when I meditated, when I started to relax, and it came some burning sensation, the left side, left into the throat, and into the nose. It was very unpleasant, mm-hmm. But what came after that was that I couldn't breathe freely. It started to such interrupted breathing, and then I just tried to relax, and it came in this way, prolonged, interrupted breathing, and then I noticed that some voices like coming out from the throat, and it was very...
I think sometimes, often what can happen is that when we come into this practice, we're sometimes a little bit apprehensive about what's going to happen. Or even sometimes in a group situation, sometimes people feel a little bit nervous that they're not going to be able to do it as well as other people, and people are going to notice that they can't do it as well as others, and so they get a little bit nervous and apprehensive. And of course that can cause all sorts of difficulties. Sometimes then people start to hyperventilate a little bit, sometimes there's some pain in the chest and so forth. So often this is symptomatic of the fact of this some sort of fear or anxiety about the practice being not being able to do it well or so forth. So we're going to talk a little bit more about that later in the retreat. But again, at the beginning of the meditation, it's very helpful to, if you notice any of these fear or anxiety or worries about not doing it properly or not being good enough or something, is to just let that go, let it go, let it go, let it go, let it go. Or the alternative, of course, is sometimes people come into the practice with some sort of expectation, you know, oh, I'm hoping that I'm having a good experience. And of course, also expectation then can lead to worry, because if we're expecting to be able to do this sort of well, and then all of a sudden there's a little bit of difficulty or something, then that can create a lot of anxiety. I'm not doing it very well here. So therefore, if that sort of thing comes up, is just let that go, let that go, let that go, let that go, and to practice again this acceptance, to acknowledge that, you know, that all of us as a beginner are completely distracted and often very dull, and that's what this practice is about overcoming those imbalances that we all have now, and not to have this idea that somehow, you know, I'm okay, actually. I need a little bit of work, but I think I can focus pretty well on the breath. If we go into the practice with this attitude, then often we end up with a lot of frustration, maybe even anxiety or worry that I can't meditate and I'm no good, and so forth. So if we notice any of that sort of stuff, we just let it go, let it go. And I think you'll find then, if we can really start to work on that relaxation, relaxing the body and the mind, then we're going to move forward well. And then one other point is on the relaxing the body, and I brought that into the meditation nearly every time, is that often people also feel like in meditation they have to make their breathing rhythmic, they have to make their breathing very subtle. And so people try to do that. They notice their breathing is very coarse or rough, and then they try to change that. They try to make it more rhythmic, they try to make it more and more subtle. But this is not going to work, because by doing that artificially, you're depriving your body of oxygen that it needs. And so then if you do that, then after some time you're going to go, because you're not getting enough oxygen. So don't do that. I mean, whatever the breath's doing. I mean, often when we come into meditation, maybe we have an agitated mind, you know. And if we have an agitated mind, agitated body, the body will need more air. So you'll find that when you sit down, that often at the start, your breathing is very rough. You know, you're sort of like this. But that's because of the agitated mind and body. But as you sit there quietly and relax the body, relax the mind, then you'll find naturally your body will need less air. Naturally, your breathing will start to settle down. But don't force that. And so just allow that to happen. And then in the meditation, if your breathing starts to get more rough and coarse again, it's because probably we have some agitation in the body or mind. Okay. And that's a sign to highlight, oh, okay, I need to relax more again. But don't try to force the breathing, because if we do force the breathing, then we can end up in all this sort of, you know, this taking gasps of air and so forth. So just let it happen slowly. Anything else anyone would like to bring up?
When you said that you focus on breathing and on movement of abdomen, which is the main thing, what is the other context around that? Do you focus more on the breathing, moving or movement of the air, or movement of the energy, or movement of the abdomen wall, movement of muscles, or even conceptually, like breathing in all bad things and getting out of good things? Like,
so. So remember here, in this shamatha practice, we are focusing on a single object. And whatever that object is, we need to use what's called bare attention. Bare attention means to observe that object directly. And if that object is a physical object, such as the physical sensations of the breath, bare attention means don't visualize. Don't imagine, you know, the breath going up and out and imagine that it is white light or black smoke going out. None of that. Of course, some meditations do the visualization, and in certain meditations, visualization can be very powerful to help with that practice. But here in the shamatha practice, we're not visualizing, we're not imagining, we're not trying to imagine subtle energies moving through the body. We are, with bare attention, directly observing the physical sensations of the breath, and in this practice, the physical sensations in the area of the abdomen. That's it. Tomorrow we're going to look at the nostrils, so tomorrow, with bare attention, we focus in this small area of any sensations in this area. That's it. Sure.
Yeah. I really encourage people to continue meditation. You have to be
I mean, I've talked to, that's very good. Thank you for that. I mean, I've talked to a number of people, like I said, the Canadian lady, but I've had a number of other people also who have had serious physical debilitating problems. And very often the case has been is that, yes, there is some physical debilitation there, but a large percentage of the suffering they were experiencing was self-induced through this aversion, you know, oh, this is going to cause me problems in my life. I'm not going to be able to do all the things I want to do. Oh, I wish it would go away. And that aversion actually produced a huge percentage of their suffering. And if they could simply let go of that, just relax and accept, as in your case and many other people's case, then yes, maybe there is a little bit of physical thing, but it's not really causing a huge issue in our life, that physical debilitation. So that's what I was trying to emphasize here, is that, you know, maybe some people do have naturally fairly intense physical debilitation, but whatever level it is, at least we can avoid making it worse, magnifying it by having aversion. If we can really practice acceptance, then at least we won't do that. So I think, yes, good advice you've given. So anyone in that situation, then that is very helpful. Okay, let's start now, before we go for a break, we've got 5 or 10 minutes, just a short review of what we sort of introduced yesterday afternoon, just to give the context again for the Mahamudra that we're going to be following in this retreat. So again, maybe you'd like to have a look at your three vehicles chart in the middle of your booklet. It's the first chart, I think, after the end of the text. And we saw here that when Buddhism spread from India, it spread through the two languages of Pali and Sanskrit. And when it was spreading through the Pali language, these teachings were based on the Four Noble Truths. And there, the sort of the goal of the spiritual path is this personal liberation from suffering, this goal of nirvana. And that the traditions that are based on the Pali scriptures now include, of course, Sri Lankan, Burmese, Thai, Laos, Cambodia, down through Southeast Asia. And in these traditions, then, when we talk about the spiritual path, often we talk about, you hear about the Noble Eightfold Path, these eight practices that are the core of the spiritual path. But as we saw yesterday, we can condense these eight practices into three core areas of practice: ethics, concentration, wisdom. So on the basis of ethical lifestyle, we enter into the concentration practice, developing single point of concentration. And then on that basis, using that single point of concentration, then we enter into the wisdom practice, investigating the nature of reality. Because the Buddhist assertion is that it's our distorted view of reality that's the root of all of our suffering. And here in the Theravada traditions, it's acknowledged that the fundamental ignorance or the fundamental distortion of reality that we have is we have a distorted view of how we see ourselves existing. We overinflate the sense of me. We believe there's this autonomous, self-sufficient self here. And that's how we relate to ourselves and the world. And that's a false, distorted view of person, according to the Theravada. If we can realize there's no such self, that we do not exist in this overinflated, solid, autonomous way, then we can overcome all of our mental afflictions, suffering, and achieve nirvana. Then in the Mahayana vehicle, which is coming from the Sanskrit tradition, which includes now Chinese Buddhism, Korean, Zen, Vietnamese, and Tibetan Buddhism, then here, these are based a lot on the perfection of wisdom teachings from the Buddha. And here, the Buddha was saying that there is a deeper level of ignorance than merely grasping onto this autonomous self. that at the deepest level, our distortion of reality is we believe that there's an independent me and an independent objective world out there. And that if, and that by realizing that there is no independent me, no independent world, which is this realization of emptiness, which of course is one of our main topics a bit later in the retreat, we can not only achieve personal liberation from suffering, but we can achieve the goal of enlightenment, because that goal of enlightenment means we're fully awakened. We are most effective then in helping to liberate others. So the goal of the Mahayana traditions is the goal of enlightenment, so that not only we can liberate ourselves from suffering, but then we can really be most effective in helping to liberate everyone else from suffering as well. And then we saw that the Vajrayana vehicle, or Tantra sometimes it's called. And in Tantra or Vajrayana, like the Mahayana, we have the same goal of enlightenment. We have the same motivation for that of bodhicitta. And we have to develop the same wisdom, this wisdom of emptiness, realizing no independent me, independent world. And what we saw yesterday was the difference then in Tantra is that in Tantra or Vajrayana, we're trying to gain access to a deeper level of our mind. We're trying to gain access to the deepest level of our mind, this mind that's often called the mind of clear light or very subtle mind. Because if we can gain access to that in meditation and use that level of mind to realize emptiness, because that mind is so powerful, we can accelerate the spiritual path to enlightenment. So here, Mahamudra is, of course, coming from the Sanskrit tradition. So Mahamudra is a system of practice that enables us to achieve enlightenment. And this system of practice was brought into Tibet through great Indian masters like Tilopa and Naropa. And into Tibet through Marpa and Milarepa and so forth. And this formed the basis of the Kagyu school of Tibetan Buddhism. But here we're following what's called Geluk Mahamudra. And the Geluk school of Tibetan Buddhism came originally through the teachings of great Indian master Lama Atisha, who brought in the what's called the Lam Rim structure of practice into Tibet. And then that was later expanded upon by great Tibetan master Lama Tsongkhapa. And then Lama Tsongkhapa, because of that, is considered to be the founder of the Geluk school of Tibetan Buddhism. But as we're going to see, Lama Tsongkhapa also then, using these Mahamudra instructions from the Kagyu tradition, put together the Geluk Mahamudra system of practice. And so that's what we're looking at in this retreat. And we'll have a little bit more look at that, how that originated in the next session. So we're following then in this retreat this system of practice of Mahamudra, particularly the Geluk version of that, which was really put together from this, again, this great Tibetan master, Lama Tsongkhapa, based on the Kagyu tradition, based on the Mahamudra instructions that came from India. So that's what we're going to be looking at in this retreat. And as we briefly saw yesterday, that within all of these three vehicles, we have really the same three core areas of practice: ethics, concentration, wisdom. Concentration practice, often, particularly in the Mahayana tradition, is called shamatha practice, because this is the level of concentration we're trying to cultivate. And then the wisdom practice is often referred to as vipassana or vipassana in Pali. And in the Mahayana, again, the vipassana practice, the wisdom practice, is this wisdom of emptiness. And we saw that we have also this Vajrayana vehicle. And the Vajrayana vehicle, or that level of practice, also was transmitted into Tibet. In fact, the Vajrayana level of practice only really started to become widely practiced in India from about the 8th century onwards. And by that time, Buddhism had spread to most countries. Whereas it's exactly at that time that Buddhism spread to Tibet. So when Buddhism spread to Tibet, not only did we have the Mahayana teachings, but you have all the Vajrayana teachings as well going into Tibet. And so this Mahamudra system of practice, which enables us to achieve enlightenment, contains the Mahayana level of instructions, plus it contains the Vajrayana level of instructions. So what we're going to see in this text that we're following is that there are two levels of Mahamudra practice. There's what's called Sutra Mahamudra, which is the Mahayana level, and then there's a Tantra Mahamudra, which is the Vajrayana level. So what we're going to see is there's three core areas of practice: the ethics, concentration, wisdom, and that can be applied at both the Sutra and the Tantra level of practice. So that's what we're going to be looking at in this text. So again, the two core elements of the practice, and on the basis of ethics, there's also at that level we talk about a lot of the foundation practices, that what's called preliminary practices. A lot of these practices are practices in common with the Theravada level of practice. So if we want to engage in these two core practices of Shamatha and Vipassana, then we need the foundation practices. So that's what we're going to be looking at sort of first in the text. Then we're going to be looking at the Shamatha and then the Vipassana practice. So the foundation practices, we're going to be looking at and practicing some of those in that first session after lunch each day. The Shamatha part of the practice we're going to be working with in the morning sessions. So again, in the Mahamudra practice, there, as we're going to see, the main emphasis is to focus on the mind. So in the Shamatha practice, we're going to primarily be using the mind as the object. But as I said yesterday evening, many people find this very challenging to observe the mind. So today and tomorrow, we're going to prepare for that by using the breath to hopefully get a little bit of stability and clarity so that we can have a better chance of then starting to observe the mind. But then from the day after tomorrow onwards, we're going to use the mind as the object of our Shamatha practice. And then we're going to go into the Vipassana practice, and then we're going to look at this idea, this wisdom of emptiness. So that's and so that those meditations for the Vipassana we'll be doing in the other two afternoon sessions. And then, of course, to balance that Shamatha Vipassana, we need the compassion side of the practice. And so that's what we're going to be focusing on in each evening session. So again, that's sort of the structure that we're going to follow. And on that note, it's time for a tea break. So let's have a morning tea break. Come back at 10:45. Again, in that session, we're going to start with a meditation, so make sure you're on time. And then we'll do one 24-minute session there, and then we'll start to look at the text after that.